Present to you, Mr. Jim Carnegie.
Thank you, Mr. Dean, and good morning, everybody. Nice to see a few people here and a few faces that we haven't seen before. Now, as Mr. Dean said, my name's Jim Carnegie, and some people accuse me of being Scottish. But that's only because I can say it's a braw bricht, moonlicht, nicht to nicht, Mrs. Richt, with all the acts in the right place. When Craig asked me if I'd like to give a short presentation at this lecture series, I thought, well, what will I speak about? What topic? And it occurred to me that everybody is going to be speaking about some aspect or other about proving something or another about British Israel. And I thought I'll try and discuss something else. Why don't I go a step further and show our audience what impact this knowledge can have on their lives? Now, I realize that everyone here is not going to be affected in the same way. But I know some of you could have your lives changed by the knowledge you receive this weekend. Now, how do I know that? Because it happened to me. And I know dozens of other people who are affected in the same way. In fact, over the past 35 years, I've met hundreds of people whose lives were affected and changed by this very knowledge. Now, I'm going to spend the time I have giving you a short history of the experiences, the changes that I've experienced. Now, actually, my life hasn't been all that interesting, but you're not going to know that until I've finished. But even the drabbest life does have a few interesting highlights. Now, I was born in 1938, so I'll be 60 years old this year. An interesting thing happened the day after I was born. The day after I was born, the British Prime Minister stood outside number 10 Downing Street and declared peace on earth. Now, there's not that many people that has happened to. That's a slight exaggeration. It sounds very good. Actually, I was born in the 29th of September, 1938. And that was the day the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flew to Munich to talk with Adolf Hitler with a view to trying to stop World War II. Now, the fact that World War II began less than a year after I was born, it sort of shows the impact that my birth had on world peace. So I was about 7 years old when the war ended. I just remember it was a time of scarcity. Everything was rationed, you know. All your food, clothing, petrol was rationed, but that didn't really affect too many people at that time because not all that many of our parents had cars. It was as I say, everything was very short and very short supply. Now, when I got to about 9 or 10 years old, when I was at school, we used to learn to read. The class, all the class had a little reading book, and we'd stand up, take it in turns to read a few sentences out of the reading book. When I got, as I say, about 9 or 10, we were given this reading book, which is actually a book on ancient history in the Middle East. Now, the only thing I can put that down to is, well, there was a shortage of reading books, and they sort of lobbed a few over there and said, look, that'll sort of keep them occupied. Now, in our normal history lessons, we were learning about William Wallace and Robert the Bruce. And I can tell you for a fact that there's not too much that's true about Braveheart, according to the history I learned at school. But in our reading book, we were reading about the Persians, the Assyrians, the Phoenicians, and a king called Xerxes. We couldn't pronounce his name anyway, but here we were reading all this stuff, and I remember thinking, well, where are the Assyrians and the Phoenicians today? And why aren't we? Why isn't Scotland mentioned here? And England? Now, where did we come from? And so that question was tucked in my mind all through my teenage years. I never thought to ask anybody else about it. Just had this question in my mind. All through my teenage years. And as I got up in years in my teens, I became a regular reader of the Reader's Digest. And then, suddenly, in January 1960, a few months after my 21st birthday, advert in the Reader's Digest, who are the people of the British Commonwealth in the United States? You know, send for our free booklet and we'll explain it all. Well, I was right into that. Oh, straight away. And I got the booklet, and I read it, and I was staggered. I was dumbfounded at this information. In the current Scottish parlance, I was gobstopped. I couldn't believe it. But there it was. But I was in a quandary, because my passion was soccer. And if I wasn't playing it, I was training for it. And if I wasn't training for it, I was watching it. And if I wasn't watching it, I was arguing about it. And I couldn't bring this thing up among my friends, because it had something to do with the Bible and religion. And you just did not discuss things like that with my friends. Now, this state of affairs lasted for the next 3 years. And meanwhile, I was writing for more booklets and more material. And I was getting deeper and deeper into all this religious aspect of things. And I came to a point where I thought, well, I have to do something about this. But I couldn't tell anybody. I just could not bring myself to tell anybody. And it ended up, I left home a few years later, and then a few years after that, I ended up in England among the hated enemy. And I discovered they weren't such a bad lot after all. You know, what? Once you could understand what they were saying. Now, I've realized over the years that when you can't understand what someone is saying, it's 10 to 1 they can't understand what you're saying either. And people say to me, oh, you haven't changed your accent. And I thought, you want to hear me 40 years ago. And you wouldn't know what I was talking about. But while I was in England, I met a young girl from Sydney, Australia. I mean, the other side of the world. And believe it or not, she had responded to that same advert in the Reader's Digest. And one thing led to another, and, you know, we're celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary this year. In fact, this coming week. But this all began with the knowledge of the origins of the British and American people. Now, I've watched a few programs on TV, a series called, it's either Turning Points in History or History's Turning Points, one or the other like that. And it deals with different affairs, different things that happened, events that happened in history that changed the course of history. You know, like the Spanish Armada. One of them was on the Battle of Britain, or the evacuation of Dunkirk. Things like that. They changed the course of history. And my own personal life, I can look back to the day in 1960 that I wrote for this booklet on the origins of the British and American people. And that was a turning point in my life. Now, in closing, I want to tell you that there are three ways that you can receive what you hear today. First of all, you can say that's a load of rubbish, and you're quite entitled to say that. Or you can say, well, isn't that interesting? You know, that is really great to know that information. The third way you can receive this information is like a young lady who talked to my wife 20-odd years ago. And she said to my wife, when I read that booklet, I knew there must be a God. And that's the whole crux of the matter. When you come to realize there is a God, then that has an impact on your life. That is what will change your life. And for anyone who comes to that decision or comes to that understanding today, I can say that this weekend will change your life.
Thank you, Jim, and we could understand every word. And on behalf of everyone here, we'd like to congratulate you on your 30, and Lynn on your 30 years of married life. And I hope you can communicate well together. Just a reminder, there's a lot of booklets back there. There are some that have got little tags on them saying they are sample copies, which means you're not supposed to take them home. But others, there's many booklets there which and magazines which you can take. Just take what you feel is necessary. And there is also, as I said yesterday to those who weren't here yesterday, we will be putting together from the church that I belong to, the United Church of God, a new booklet on the US and Britain in prophecy.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. It's nice to be here with all of you again today. I'm not entirely sure, but we may have heard in the previous presentation the most important thing we'll have heard this weekend. He addressed the issue of where, as in the United States, we'd say the rubber meets the road. And it's all well and good, these things that we've been exploring, but I think really the crux of the matter is, as we've already heard, is what we do with this. Now, let me get into my dimension of the presentations today. But before I do, as I was listening to what he had to say about various ones of us standing before you and speaking this weekend and trying to prove this or that or the other thing, I'm reminded of the old school of theology graduation, where the academic dean stood up and addressed those young men that were about to graduate from this particular school of theology. And he said, well, I'm sorry to have to inform you as you're on the eve of graduation that we've come to discover that half of what we taught you during your stay here is not true. The problem is we're not entirely sure which half is which. So it is with that awareness, you know, I've wrestled and delighted with and enjoyed this subject over the years, really about the last 12 when I've engaged in a sustained examination of it. I think the key has been to try not to take myself or my conclusions too seriously. These things, I think we are spot on target in terms of the ultimate conclusion, but some of the pirouettes that we do around different points and so on, to me, they are convicting and convincing, and I'm here to share that with you as we work our way through this material this morning, and then again, for those of you who still want more punishment later this afternoon. To maybe touch base with where I started yesterday, there are some concepts that I'd like for you to keep in mind. I won't elaborate quite as fully as I did yesterday, but number one, what we do today has a long-term impact in our lives. It's like Paul said, we reap what we sow. There are consequences for ill or for good for our actions. Secondly, I would ask that we keep in mind as we look at this material that I'll present today, the fact that in Leviticus 23, God talks about certain holy days, and it's a matter of biblical record that in Israelitish history, in antiquity, key events happened to the people of Israel in conjunction with those holy day dates. It's a coincidence, or maybe not, that same pattern persists in the story of the Anglo-American and the Israelite people in general in more recent or modern times. Third concept is that God does intervene in human history. The phrase that was turned as we listened to the first message here today, there is a God out there, and He is actively involved. He's actively involved personally in our lives. He's also actively involved in the fate and fortune, the future, the present of the nations. And as I'll try to show, at least as it strikes me today, He has been involved in certain ways in the past. A fourth concept, there are certain patterns in terms of what we see in past historical events, and they intersect, they dovetail, they reproduce themselves in a startling way in terms of some of what we read in the prophecies in books like Daniel, Revelation, some of the major and indeed some of the minor prophets. And I'll bring some of those parallels to our attention as we look at the material we'll cover today. One thing that I probably neglected to do yesterday in my own tradition and my own studies and the background from whence I come, it might be good to just simply define to identify the principal parties. I perceive the descendants of the half-tribe of Joseph, or the Ephraimites, to represent in modern history the people from the Commonwealth nations. I believe that's where what we're looking at when we see the story of the British Commonwealth. It's, in essence, an Ephraimitish history. The Manassites, the other half-tribe of the tribe of Joseph, I believe we're looking at people from my part of the world, principally what we would call the United States of America. We tend over there to have an anti-monarchist, pro-Republican, if you will, perspective. I'm not talking about necessarily me personally, but I'm talking about our national history and the way in which it was forged. George III, I was talking to a fellow this morning about good old George III, and he was not a heroic figure in our tradition. Perhaps in English history, he comes out looking a little bit better, and I think it has a bit to do with that, but it may have roots that go a lot further back, and I'll draw that to our attention as we move along today. To me, in my scheme of things, Reuben finds expression as well in more recent and modern times, and I think we're looking, in essence, at many of the people that populate the present-day region of what we would call the nation-state today of France. Now let's talk about Reuben for just a moment before we go down with the lights and bring some of the images on screen here in a moment. In Genesis 37, we see an interesting story recorded. Young Joseph, at about age 16, 17 years old, is dispatched by his father to go and check and see how his brothers are doing out in the field. As he approaches, the brothers see him, and they make some rather unflattering remarks. They talk about, here comes that dreamer, and before you know it, someone has concocted a plan to murder Joseph. Who is it that says, hold on, maybe we shouldn't do that, let's throw him in yonder pit? Well, of course, you probably know the story fairly well. It's brother Reuben. Why was that? Reuben, I don't think, liked Joseph any better than the other brothers. You know, we tend not in our family relationships to like the fair-haired child. Maybe we like him least of all because daddy or mom loves him best, as it were. Reuben was the firstborn. He was the oldest male offspring, and as such, he had a peculiar and a special responsibility. When Jacob was not there in that ancient world society, when the father or the mother were not there to take care of the children, the oldest male offspring typically received that responsibility. So you see in Reuben an interesting ambivalence. He doesn't particularly care for Joseph, but he knows he's held accountable if Joseph doesn't come home safe and well and good. The surprise he registers, and even the Bible as you get toward the end of chapter 37 is very explicit. It says his plan was to ultimately rescue Joseph out of that pit and take him back home safely to his father. Now, with that thought in mind, let's go down with the lights, and Mr. Shaw, if you can hit the advance button, and we'll, or maybe we don't need to go down with the lights. Let's see what we have in terms of, I think we probably better go down a bit. And I probably had better turn this on. Okay, Craig, I am not seeing how to turn this. If you can maybe send someone up to show me where the switch is. I'm a technical moron. You could inscribe on the head of a straight pin what I know about mechanical type things. But I can move forward at least at this point in taking a look at what we see here. We talked yesterday a bit about the so-called revolt of the colonies, the American Revolution. I want to tie some loose ends there if I can. Here you see the surrender of General Burgoyne, a British general who engaged a colonial general named Horatio Gates. It was really, in many respects, the first significant victory of the colonial army. There had been victories, but there was not any full-scale pitched engagement, really, that the Americans won up until the Battle of Saratoga. It is an interesting fact that it fell on October the 17th, the year 1777, which in that year happened to be the second day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, so once again, we get that pattern. Now, if you'll move on to the next slide. Here you see someone in obvious, well, maybe not obvious, but if you know European history, that's not an Englishman. Okay, the garb would imply French background. After the Battle of Saratoga, King Louis in France decided that it was worth the risk. And if you remember a little of what we talked about yesterday, in the previous battle of this series of battles, seven of them during the second 100 Years' War, France had lost huge tracts of North American territory. And they didn't perceive the end of the story, the ultimate long-term outcome. They didn't know that their efforts would fail. In fact, what they attempted to do was use the colonial rebellion as a cat's paw to help them gain leverage, and their intent was to retrieve many of those territories that had been lost. Hence, you have figures that are probably somewhat known, like the Marquis de Lafayette. He would go back to France eventually and stir up another revolution called the French Revolution, or help to stir it up in 1789. Another illustration of this trend, if we can go to the next image. Well, this is a classic French way of interpreting it. And by the way, lest you think I'm francophobic, I'm basically Irish, English, a bit of French thrown in, and probably a touch of American Indian, about 1/64th by the time it's filtered out. This is a French way of viewing France's involvement in the American Revolution. The avenging angel of France driving back the wicked, dastardly British. Meanwhile, the simpleton Americans dance around the flagpole in the ground beneath. In point of fact, this particular piece of artwork came out to commemorate a battle which the French weren't even there for. Okay, such is propaganda, and I know probably in Australia all of your politicians tell the truth, and no one would dare present. It's like it is in the United States here. Well, that's too bad. This gives the sense of a combined Franco-American involvement in this endeavor. And I would submit to you, and we'll see several examples of this here this morning and some this afternoon, that what you're looking at is a kind of unwitting expression of what I've termed as Reubenite ambivalence. Ironically, Reuben will act repeatedly through this epoch of history to support one branch of the house of Joseph, the Manassite branch, the American branch, and in the process, they're trying to strike a blow against the Ephraimite house. Highly ironic. Next illustration I'll show. Let's advance to that one. Again, classic Valley Forge, a difficult period for the American revolutionaries. George Washington on the right. And notice that he's flanked by the Frenchman Lafayette. Now, that's not a single example. In the next illustration, what we'll see, the French dispatched another one of their old, semi-retired generals. The climactic battle of the American Revolution was in 1781 at a town called Yorktown along the eastern United States, at that time, colonial seaboard. Washington, the father of America, our version of your Admiral Philip, is flanked on either side, to our right, the Marquis de Lafayette, and on the left, Rochambeau. Typically, when you get generals together, people with strong will and assertive personalities, it is not surprising to see friction and conflict. Rochambeau was a very experienced man, and if you ever have occasion to read some of the history, one of the things that's somewhat startling is these two men got along famously. Rochambeau was willing to defer to Washington, and it proved to be a very harmonious and very successful relationship, which ultimately resulted in the driving back of the British. Now, let's move on, because there's yet another major element in the next image that we'll see here. Who was the greatest sea power in the late 18th century? Well, that's a no-brainer. Her Majesty's Navy, His Majesty's Navy at that point in time. And yet, the success of the rebels, the colonials at Yorktown, was in no small way, and maybe even in the final analysis, was guaranteed by this schematic that you see. Somehow, a French admiral named de Grasse was able to thread his way, come out of Europe, thread his way through the West Indies, completely escape Rodney, who was the main admiral patrolling that region for the British Navy. He then moved up north, headed for Yorktown. Graves, the British admiral responsible for patrolling the Virginia Capes in the critical region, knew that de Grasse was on his way and somehow inexplicably allowed the French admiral to get into the bay, dispatch 3,000 reinforcements, refit his ships. And then if we can go on to the next visual, this is a British caricature. The British are not very kind, are they, in terms of caricaturing the French? De Grasse here, and then let's go to the next next image. He was able to seal off the Chesapeake Bay area and guarantee the defeat of Charles Cornwallis, a very brilliant general from Great Britain, who was now trapped in Yorktown with no way of escaping to live to fight another day. And it is a remarkable story. Now, let's go to the next image. Meanwhile, and if you look once again at this story from the perspective that I'm trying to sketch it, Reuben, Ephraim, and Manasseh, the tale of two half-brothers and another sibling, it was fated for France to fail. De Grasse, flush with confidence that was born out of his rather unexpected success in helping to seal the fate of the British in Yorktown, he decided that was easy, turned his fleet around, sailed back to the West Indies. And, of course, this time Rodney was waiting for him, captured the flagship as well as de Grasse, and here you see de Grasse offering his sword of surrender to George III with Rodney, the British admiral, in the background. Happenstance? Well, perhaps, but when you understand it through the perspective that we're looking at today, it certainly does make a bit more sense. It's a bit more relevant. Now, let's move ahead to the next image. Yorktown was a relatively brief battle, lasting somewhere in the neighborhood of a quarter an hour, a little bit more than that. The English wound up defeated. The next image, if we can go there. Barbara Tuchman, and then we'll sharpen the focus here, an author that I made reference to yesterday, made the observation about the American Revolution, or the so-called American Revolution. The British lost the war more than the Americans won the war. And she goes on for 150 pages or so to explain why that was the case. I'll share some concepts with you here. If you'll go to the next image, what we see is Charles Cornwallis, the man I referred to as a British commanding officer at Yorktown. This man lost one battle in his entire military career. It was at Yorktown. Prior to this, he had never lost any significant engagement. Afterwards, he was dispatched to India over in this region of the world and wound up penetrating the territory of India, and he was a key instrument, if you will, in laying the foundation for the British Empire, the linchpin in terms of the subcontinent of Asia. The next illustration, if we can go there, again, the caricature artist of the age. Yesterday I talked a bit about the fact that God places people in offices and positions of authority in order to serve his purpose. You can see the title. I mean, this, I guess this could fit any age, though. Right? A pair of politicians. That's the title. It is remarkable the collection of incompetence, idiots, and nincompoops that surrounded George III. One case in point, and this is one example of many that could be drawn, George Germain was the secretary for the colonies. George Germain in the previous war had been court-martialed for cowardice on the field of battle, banned from ever serving in any military capacity whatsoever from that point forward. And yet, within a decade or so, he wound up, in essence, from London, managing the British war effort. Okay. One of a host of almost tragicomic characters that played a role and acted out these developments in the sweep of British history. Now, if we can go on to the next next visual. What's going on here? And I think most people in the audience here today come at this from the angle of what does the Bible have to say about these things? As a secular historian, I suppose one could say you look at the facts and nothing but the facts. And no, we can't prove certain things in a test tube, but I think even the caricature artists of the late 18th century had certain insights. Here you see a Beelzebub-type figure showing British leadership themselves, their reflection in a mirror. And as a historian, I suppose I could say, well, that's maybe overdrawn. But as someone who has studied the Bible over the years, I read in the book of Daniel about angelic beings holding up things, stirring up spirits. I read in the book of Kings the fact that God, I believe it was King Ahab, needed to die at a certain time. And there's a vignette cutaway where you go, in essence, to the third heaven, and God says, now who will be a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets and get this guy to go out and get himself killed tomorrow in the battle? We may not be able to put our finger precisely where those kinds of things happen, but I think we're foolish and short-sighted unless we admit that they do take place, and they take place toward furthering God's purpose. Next illustration. Here is the scene of the British surrendering their arms at Yorktown to the American colonial victors. It's interesting that the song that the band, back in those days, bands accompanied, I don't know today, I guess we would have, I don't know what we would have, I don't know who the popular recording artists are here, you know, accompanying the Australian Army to battle, but in those days they had a military band, and they went out, and they chose a tune as they surrendered their arms called A World Turned Upside Down. And I find that particular selection interesting in light of the fact that when you read in Acts chapter 17, verse 6, the apostles who had been brought before the magistrates, their accusers said what? These are the people who turn the world upside down. And from the perspective of the average citizen in Jerusalem or Palestine of those days, probably that was about the limit of their vision. But from the Christian perspective, we realize they weren't turning the world upside down. They were founding the Church of God, laying the basis for Christianity. Now, granted, that was a spiritual foray or an advancement. This is a physical one. But nevertheless, it is bringing closure, I would submit to you, to, or at least a part of closure, to that promise in Genesis 48 that those two half-tribes of Joseph would separate in the long run. Now, let's move along to the next illustration. The peace settlement you can see here. On the left, you see the American delegation, and on the right, oh my, the British refused to pose. They weren't in a particular good attitude about it. Now, the cartoons commemorating the peace settlement, next visual, if we can go to that, were interesting. The settlement was in Paris, and it took place in September, and I thought, aha, probably another holy day date. This is going to be good. It will add to this subjective stuff that I'm presenting to you here today. And sure enough, it was not. And then a month or two later, as I was in the Chattanooga, Tennessee Public Library, paging through a book of 18th century cartoons, I came across this, and I was deeply gratified, I shall say. There wasn't CNN back in those days to give us instantaneous feedback on what was going on in the world. On the other hand, they did announce it, and they would have town criers or heralds go out into the street and say, you know, 10 o'clock is all and all is well, or in this case, peace between the colonies and the mother country. And if you can see the date, you can sharpen the focus, Mr. Shaw, just to touch on that. The date that peace was proclaimed in the streets of London is October the 6th, 1783. Happened to be the Day of Atonement. And if you know what the Day of Atonement symbolizes and represents, one of the main themes is that of reconciliation. Now, maybe it's happenstance and accidental. I don't know. Oh, thank you. Let there be light. And what do you know? There was light. It is one of those curiosities where you begin to see this thread emerge in the story, this triangular relationship between Ephraim, Manasseh, and Reuben. Now, although peace, let's go to the next visual, was proclaimed, it wasn't all over yet. This illustration, you see the American Indian being embraced by Mother Britannia, but the figure in the right foreground makes disparaging remarks. You may think you have your freedom now, but give it some time, and things will go back to the natural order of things. The British weren't really convinced that the American Revolution was the right thing. A world turned upside down, as I mentioned earlier. Now let's move on to the next visual. We can take a look at that. Meanwhile, the Americans confuted everyone by coming together in a matter of about 7 to 10 years, getting their governmental house in order. They did it through an imperfect document called the United States Constitution. But on the other hand, it seems to have served the interest of that particular world polity fairly well over the last couple of centuries. Meanwhile, France, who, if you recall, had gotten into the fracas, hoping to regain losses that she had sustained in the French and Indian War. Let's go to the next illustration. The classic textbook photo that you will see. What goes on by 1789? France is in chaos. The tennis court oath, which was one of the points of departure for the famous French Revolution. And France would be in tumult until a fairly ambitious young French general, well, actually he was Corsican, named Napoleon Bonaparte, would come and seize control of the reins. And we're going to spend a good bit of time this morning examining his story in a few moments. France came out of the involvement in the American Revolution primarily with huge war debts. And if you know the story of the French Revolution of 1789, a large part of that revolution was about the financial problems that France had. Not that there were other reasons and causes as well, but that certainly was a major contributing factor. Now, in the next illustration, we'll take a look at the unfolding sequence of events. There was a second war between England and the United States. It was called the War of 1812. In my view, I think what we're looking at, much like World War I and World War II, I think someday will be considered as one war separated by a long armistice. I believe the same applies conceptually to the American Revolution. Then you have a period from 1783 to 1812 of strained but somewhat civil relations. In 1812, the war re-erupts, and it lasts till 1815, providing a block of 40 years that it took. Interesting, the Bible uses that as a number, oftentimes associated with judgment or bringing matters to closure. In that 40-year time frame, the American peoples, the Manassite peoples, finally and decisively separate from their brother Ephraim. Now, if we go to the next visual, what you will see here is, now I'm not, by the way, Mr. Dean, introducing the notion of being taken up into heaven here, so you can relax. This is the apotheosis or the taking up into heaven of Benjamin Franklin, a very famous American patriot. Franklin made an interesting comment after the American Revolution ran its course. He said, "The war of the Revolution has been won, but the war of independence is still to be fought." And in many respects, that is what we see the War of 1812 accomplishing. As Leakey's title page implied, the war that nobody won. No territory changed hands. It went back to what they say, the status quo ante bellum, the way it was before the war began. But two important and crucial psychological results emerged from this conflict. The British, for their part, finally gave a grudging respect for American independence. They admitted that, no, this is not going to be, we can't turn the clock back and go back to the way it was. The Americans on the other side of the Atlantic had an enhanced sense of self-consciousness as a nation, and their confidence level rose, which fed the process that we'll see at least a part of, and some of what we have yet to look at today, of expanding to fill the North American continent. Now, if you'll move to the next visual. Another interesting sidelight to this, and to me, you know, in the States there's been a debate among my particular religious tradition of who is Ephraim and who is Manasseh. And I think we have had it correct all along. I believe there is an inherent dimension within the Manassite people that is anti-monarchist. This is the commemorative artwork that you see that the Americans produced. It was a commonplace symbol, again, one that you'll see in many textbooks, expressing American attitude relevant to the outcome of the War of 1812. And notice the inscription below. "We owe allegiance to no crown." Now, if you want to carry this a step further and root it to some degree in a concept, at least scripturally speaking, Judges chapter 8 is not a bad place to go, because you have a man whose name was Gideon. He was Manassite. He whipped the Midianites, drove them out of the land, and the people were most grateful and came to him, and I believe it's around verses 20 through 25. They said, "Gideon, be king over us, and your son and your son's son on down the line." And Gideon said, "No thanks." I suspect that is a kind of forerunner or one of those hints that you see dropped into the record of Scripture, which helps us to identify a character, trait, a quality, a feature of Manassite behavior. Somewhat conjectural on my part, but it certainly does fit the facts of history as they've emerged in the last couple of hundred years. Now, let's move on to the next illustration, because there's another dimension to this. Again, in a day and age when news didn't travel too fast, the war actually ended on Christmas Eve, 1814. It was determined at Ghent, in the Low Countries in Europe, that the War of 1812 was now officially over. Unfortunately, the news didn't reach New Orleans, and in January there was a final battle at which the British were thoroughly defeated, and many lives were lost. Here you see General Pakenham, the brother-in-law of the famous Duke of Wellington, who has taken a bullet and actually wound up dying in that battle. Next visual, you'll see the American leader, Andrew Jackson. Jackson used his military renown to eventually become president, but he had a great deal of help, interestingly enough, in that area of New Orleans from someone who knew the area very well, had access to ammunition, was able to give Jackson the kind of advice that ensured the overwhelming American victory in this war. His name was Jean Lafitte. That's not a particularly Anglo-Saxon sounding name, is it? He was a Frenchman, a French pirate that was a key contributor to facilitating, again, this separation between the Ephraimite and Manassite peoples. Now, on to the next image. And I sometimes say this fellow is a refugee from a Pepto-Bismol commercial. I don't know if you use Pepto-Bismol here, but you will recognize him, no doubt, readily as Napoleon Bonaparte. I won't cover everything about Napoleon today, which I'm sure you're glad to hear. But I will simply say that Napoleon Bonaparte is unexampled in the historical research, at least that I have done, as a major figure whose life is checkered from one end to the next, to the other, with major key events and developments coincident with the Holy Days. It is remarkable, and I will share some of those examples with you here today. Let's go on to the next illustration. Napoleon actually was not French. Like many of those people who, in our tradition, we believe were the chief rulers over resurrections of the ancient Roman Empire, Napoleon Bonaparte was actually Germanic. And let me explain how that genealogy plays out. He originated on the island, or he grew up on the island of Corsica, but his lineage goes back to this area of northern Italy, and a group of Germanic people had spilled over the Alps and settled into this region, forming the kingdom of Lombardy. He was a Lombard, which ties him in a very intimate way to the Germanic line. He, at around 16 years of age, went to France, enrolled in military school, and really was probably the most dominant figure on the political landscape, certainly the military landscape, from around 1799 until 1815, when he finally met defeat on the day of Pentecost on the fields of Waterloo. We'll go to the next illustration, and this is one of my favorite Napoleon portraits. I want you to keep that lodged in your mind, because when we talk about Waterloo this afternoon briefly, I want you to contrast what you see on screen to the image of Napoleon in the year 1815. Here you see a young, aggressive, eager, ambitious individual, somewhat smitten by an inferiority complex. He never really spoke French to the satisfaction of his French peers. He spoke with a somewhat pronounced accent. He was short in stature, hence the term in our language that's passed on, the Napoleon complex, someone who's small and tries to prove himself by making his mark in a particularly big way. Now, next image. Napoleon rose quickly through the ranks. Here you see him on the left in somewhat surprising attire. One of the things that is not too often remembered about Napoleon is that, much like David and Saul, Saul said, "You want my daughter? Go get me 100 Philistine foreskins." The idea was to get him out into harm's way so that he would be killed and removed from the scene. Napoleon had become popular in France, and the idea of the Directory, the political executive branch in France during those days, was to send him off to Egypt, hope that he was successful militarily, but he took a bullet in the process. Okay, again, those politicians, you just can't trust them, can you? Napoleon went with Napoleonic ambition. He, as you can see here, took on the dress of the Oriental despot. His idea was to become a new Alexander the Great. And he might well have accomplished it, but I think he was fated not to win in this region. He was dispatched to Egypt with the intention of helping cut relations off between Britain and the most important overseas possession that the British had, the subcontinent of Asia, what we call India today. Now, in the next image, what you'll see is another one of these propaganda pieces, the Battle of the Pyramids, which is a landmark victory for Napoleon. In point of fact, the pyramids were so far beyond that they could not be seen, but that doesn't look good to the audiences back home, does it? So you get these kind of press release type paintings. Napoleon in the lower right, his generals overrunning the Egyptian hordes. Now from there, his intent, let's go on to the next illustration. His intent, I'm sorry, I left out an important part of the story. Do any of you know who this is? You recognize this fellow? Horatio Nelson. Along with Cook, Nelson, maybe Jackie Fisher in more recent times, this is one of the main figures in British naval history. He would prove to be a nemesis for poor Napoleon. Napoleon's fleet, let's go to the next illustration, had come in and docked down around the area of Alexandria. And Nelson pulled into that region in the so-called Battle of the Nile and pretty much devastated the French fleet, making it essential now for Napoleon to be successful down in Egypt and in his campaign, which he intended to take all the way. He wanted to give problems to the British in India, but he was going to do that personally. He intended, like Alexander, to traverse the Fertile Crescent and then to move all the way across and to penetrate India from its eastern boundaries. That was the long-term plan. Well, Nelson made that almost essential because his troops no longer had an easy way to get back to France. Now, in the next visual, and this is what I was thinking we were coming up on a moment ago, if you can sharpen the focus, Mr. Shaw, and there we go, okay. The idea was to come from Egypt, go the traditional route up along this area. In the Bible, times of the Bible, we see that. And he encountered resistance from the Arabs at Acre. The British, by the way, had military advisors there who did a great deal to help the Arabs bog down the operation. Now, the interesting dimension and a sidelight to this story, which I want to share with you, Napoleon, and this was not known until 1940, when some people going through some archives in the city of Vienna, in a household that had rabbinic connections, they came across a proclamation that was predated to be read and sent out for April the 19th, 1799, the Passover. That proclamation announced the establishment of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. Boy, that sounds familiar. Now, where have I heard of that before? Oh, yeah. Arthur Balfour, the Balfour Declaration. Now, my suspicion is that God had an interest in seeing that Britain was the vehicle or the instrument, the Ephraimites representing the house of Joseph, not the Reubenites. And as is so often the case in secular history, or if you prefer, from the biblical perspective, Reuben oftentimes precedes but will fail to be supplanted, if you will, by the descendants of Joseph. Now, let's go to the next visual. And you'll see the battle. One scene is an artist reproduced it at Acre. Napoleon was never able to make it down, hence the proclamation was never sent out. The next illustration, if we'll go to some figures that you... Well, actually, this is what this is the surrender of Jerusalem in 1917. And there's an interesting twist here, too, in terms of this number that sometimes recurs in terms of our prophetic scheme and my tradition. 2,520 years seems to be a number oftentimes for withholding various things. When the Arabs surrendered on December 9th, 1917, the Turks, by the way, had fled the city, leaving the Arabs to officially surrender. It fell on the 24th day of the ninth month of the Hebrew calendar. This was precisely 2,520 years to the day, the same day on the Hebrew calendar, from the time when Jerusalem was surrendered by the Jews and given over to the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar. Fascinating stuff. Again, I'm not entirely sure what we need to make out of it, or even if we need to put undue emphasis on it. But it is interesting. And then in the next image that we'll see here, you'll see the British triumvirate, who was responsible for this in civilian dress, Edmund Allenby, the man who took Jerusalem in November. He began his military operations and took the city. On the right, Herbert Samuels, who became the British High Commissioner there. And then in the middle, of course, Arthur Balfour, who wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild. And that letter has been memorialized or immortalized, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And we know it today as the Balfour Declaration, proclaiming a homeland for the Jews. And that's drastically changed the landscape in the area of what is modern-day Israel from 1917 forward. Now, let's go ahead and move on to the next illustration. Meanwhile, back in the 1790s, and the British had whole books of caricatures on poor Napoleon. Here he is wrapped up like a mummy in Egypt. Plans didn't go the way he wanted to. He didn't make it to India. He wound up stuck in Egypt. His troops came down with dysentery. Things began to really turn sour. What would you do in a situation like that? Well, let's go to the next slide. One of the Cruikshank cartoons of his life. He left his troops behind to fend for themselves, got on a boat, and sailed back to Paris, beating home the news of his defeat. And if we can go to the next illustration. In November of 1799, he presented himself, and no one was any the wiser, as the conquering hero returned home from Egypt. Those politicians, you just can't trust them. He managed to ensconce himself in power, at first as one of three consuls, drawn from the old Roman Emperor, Roman Empire's Republic, I guess, title. From there, let's go to the next image. He worked his way up the ladder, and by the early 1800s, he had transformed himself into the Holy Roman Emperor, or maybe not so holy. It's like Voltaire's comment about the Holy Roman Empire. It was neither holy nor Roman. Napoleon became the dominant leader over the continent of Europe. Now let's go to the next image. Napoleon would probably have achieved his purposes, but for one critical nemesis, namely England. Now, when I was there in 1991 doing some research on this particular subject, I was down in the area of the Channel. And I found this little brochure, and I thought, that is really an interesting image to bridge this part of the lecture to the next points that I want to get to. The White Cliffs of Dover in an almost Golgotha style, and then superimposed upon it is the image of Napoleon. And throughout his career, he was never able to bring England under his umbrella of control and authority. Let's go to the next image. I love this cartoon. I think it's a Cruikshank piece. But around 1801 and 1802, there was peace between Britain and France. But Napoleon anticipated resuming warfare. On the left, Prime Minister Addington standing astride the classic symbol of John Bull, the British beef. Okay, he's protecting that. And if you can read between the lines, he's saying, who's afraid? And then in between the lines, you can see that he's literally scared out of his wits. Napoleon about to unsheathe his sword and to go at it hammer and tongs against his British adversary to bring everybody under the umbrella of French imperial control. Now, as I think I mentioned yesterday, that's all well and good, but it cost money to wage war. Where did Napoleon get his financing? Let's go to the next image. The face that you'll see here is not an Australian, it's not a Brit, it's not a Frenchman, it's an American. He was the third president of the United States. His name was Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had been interested in getting access in and out of the Mississippi River, and he even dispatched a man named Robert Livingston to Paris to try to negotiate the sale of the city of New Orleans, or at least the ability to have the right of deposit of goods coming out of what at that time was along the east coast of the Mississippi River, America's heartland. Livingston met with all kinds of resistance. They treated him impolitely. It looked like the mission was going to be a failure for sure. But guess what? Let's go to the next image. Monsieur Talleyrand, on the fourth day of unleavened bread, would have been, let me give you a date, I think it was April 10th. My eye is not falling on it. April 10th in the year 1803, literally shocked Livingston to the point that Livingston turned the offer down because he was so amazed. Napoleon on the 10th told Talleyrand to make the offer. On the 11th, Talleyrand met with Livingston and said, "Well, we won't sell you New Orleans, but we'll sell you the whole of the Louisiana Territory." Just 828,000 square miles of territory, some of the finest farmland in the world. Livingston recovered himself that evening, came back the next day, and negotiations began in earnest. And really, by about the seventh day of unleavened bread, the framework of the deal had basically been laid. Now let's move on to the next illustration. It was early May before the formal treaty arrangements were finally signed, as you can see in this commemorative piece of artwork. But Livingston, next slide, had something interesting to say, and you may have read this in various pieces of literature over the years. After the sale was complete, Livingston noted, "We have lived long, and we have lived long, but this is the noblest work of our whole lives. From this day forward, the United States takes their place among the powers of first rank." Now, Napoleon, and Napoleon's finance minister, whose name escapes me at the moment, but his finance minister wrote a book about these proceedings, and that is the primary historical resource from which we know some of the inner workings and motivations about these things. He wrote down a quote that Napoleon made, and I want you to think in terms of this, think about what I say, in terms of Reubenite ambivalence. With one hand, establishing the house of Manasseh for the purpose of trying to crush the house of Ephraim. Napoleon made these observations. He said, "This accession of territory affirms forever the power of the United States, Manasseh, and I have just given England a maritime rival that sooner or later will lay low her pride." Fascinating. Interesting stuff. And I'm not in the least way attempting to suggest that these figures in history knew came at this from the angle that I'm coming. I think they were quite unwitting agents. Now, to add to the irony of all of this, the United States in those days, in 1803, was a fairly new and not that prosperous nation. They didn't have $15 million, which was the purchase price, to just lay down on the table. So they borrowed the money from England. History abounds with ironies. Let's go ahead and move on to the next illustration. Very symbolic, the French tricolor being lowered and replaced by the flag emblem of the United States of America. And in this, my mind goes back to 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2. The forfeiture of the double portion of the birthright by Reuben to the other firstborn son of the patriarch Jacob. Now, in the next illustration, what you'll see is one of many kinds. I'm not quite there yet. This gives a sense of the Louisiana Territory. 1763, it was in the hands of the Spanish through secret treaty, the Treaty of St. Ildefonso, and I think 1801, it was given to the French. And now let's go to the next illustration, which is a map of the Louisiana Territory, and you'll see if we can advance to the next one here. Mr. Shaw, there we go. Okay. All right. The Louisiana Purchase. Talleyrand as well. There's a bit of irony here. Livingston approached Talleyrand after the deal was done in May of 1803, and he said, "Well, sir, can you give me the boundaries? What is it exactly that we've just purchased?" And Talleyrand, typical of his particular style, said, "Sir, you've made a noble bargain for yourselves. I expect you'll make the most of it." That, by the way, maybe this would have gratified Napoleon, because the ambiguity of this region here between British and American control led to at least some frictions through the 1840s between the Americans and the British. But we worked those things out. Okay? Now, the next illustration, which is where I thought I was a moment ago. It really was, as this contemporary caricature represents, it was a battle for what would become the ability to control the world. Here you see Napoleon astride the globe trying to beat back his nemesis, the English. It's interesting that there are three passages in the Bible that are relevant here to me. Genesis 48:22, it says, "Moreover, I have given you," in reference to Joseph's children, "one portion above your brethren." And that was typical of the son who received that, the responsibility, if you will, for caring for the other children and generations down the line. It was a double portion of the birthright, and it springs out of Deuteronomy 21. In verses 15 through 17, it reads, "He," meaning any father, "shall acknowledge the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his." And then in Ezekiel 47, verse 13, it states very clearly, "Joseph shall have two portions." Now, the cartoon, if we can advance to the next image that you see here, is strikingly reminiscent of those passages, isn't it, that we just read. William Pitt the Younger slicing off what amounts to about twice the amount that you see Napoleon, who did represent one of the brothers, and the brothers each received or were to receive a portion. It was just that Joseph's descendants were to receive double the amount. What I suspect we see at this very critical time in history is Reuben and Joseph moving, going to go down easy. And as this somewhat comical, in retrospect anyway, comical illustration shows, he and his engineers and military advisors came up with all kinds of ways to bring down England. The Montgolfier brothers, I think it was, in around the 1780s, had designed a hot air balloon, and there were even notions of maybe coming across in the air. There were ideas, as you can see here, somewhat far-fetched, although we've done it in the 20th century, of tunneling under the English Channel. The main notion, of course, would have been launching a land invasion force like William of Hastings that we talked about yesterday, crossing the English Channel by sea and then dispatching the soldiers. And let's move on to the next illustration. He had the ships, and on several occasions they were there and ready to go. But as we see in the next image, he never got any further than this. And to me, this is an almost prophetic kind of illustration. The artist depicting him looking across the English Channel, wanting to strike a direct blow. If I could just get my hands on the English, to put it in American terms, it's like Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. Okay? You may have that cartoon from time to time here on some of your global type channels or stations. Now, in England, let's go to the next image. The classic symbol, the White Cliffs of Dover. If you go over there today, what you can do is go down that southeastern coastline. Let's move on to the next image. And along that coastline, the British placed what were called Martello Towers. Let's go to the next one, and I'll show you what they look like. You can actually go into these things. Several are set up as little tourist booths, and for £2 or £3, they'll let you in. And if you go up to the top, let's go to the next image, this is what you would have seen. Looking out over the English Channel, and in the distant horizon, you can see the kind of whitish area, which probably is kind of a distant view of the French coastline. But they prepared in advance for the invasion of the British Isles and anticipated, they expected. Well, it never came. Let's go to the next image. Again, Horatio Nelson played a monumental role in guaranteeing that it would not. Nelson was a remarkable man, and he anticipated what Napoleon was going to try to do. Napoleon, by 1805 or thereabouts, pretty much dominated most of the continental nations. He had a combined Franco-Spanish fleet, and the idea was to take that fleet out and lure His Majesty's Navy out into the Atlantic, and then when the English Channel lay relatively unprotected, make a mad dash across, deploy French troops along the southern English coastline, and in essence it would be all over but the shouting. Nelson was too smart for that. He anticipated what came, and let's go to the next image. In an area off the coast of Spain, the little inset map here is enlarged, the cape known as Trafalgar, Nelson caught the Franco-Spanish fleet. And if we go to the next illustration, you'll see at least one image or artist depiction of what happened. Now, much like James Wolfe in an earlier war, Nelson wound up getting himself killed, but he hung on to life in a kind of stiff upper lip British way until he knew for sure that the battle had been won, and then he surrendered up his life for king and country. Ironically, this in many ways is the decisive moment, I think, in the story of Napoleon. Now, there's another decade of the story to be told, but from the point in Franco or Anglo-French relations when Napoleon lost his ability to bring England under his net of control, it may have taken a while, but in the final analysis, France was ultimately going to lose. While Napoleon in 1805 was experiencing some of his greatest victories, Austerlitz in particular, and then on at Jena and various other places, the final die, as it were, had been cast, and it took place off the coast of Spain at Trafalgar. Now let's move on to the next illustration. By 1807, there was another critical battle, and this one fell on June 14th on the day of Pentecost. It was against the Russians, between Napoleon and the Russians. The battle was at a place called Friedland. And it's important for many reasons, but the one I'll bring our attention to here is by July, Napoleon, let's go to the next illustration, Napoleon had staged conspicuous conference. He actually built a large barge or a series of barges out in the middle of the Niemen River. And Alexander the First's representatives and Napoleon's representatives came together, and the peace treaty was hammered out in the Treaties of Tilsit, early July of 1807. It was through these agreements, and let's go forward now, and I think the next image is that of, yes, Alexander, Tsar Alexander the First of Russia. Alexander agreed to put himself under what was known as the Continental System. If you can't beat someone militarily, you need to wage war by other means. And one of the most effective ways of doing that, and we in our respective Commonwealth and American nations do it all the time, we wage economic warfare, sanctions, restrictions, boycotts, and the like. Napoleon and Alexander agreed, along with all the other nation-states in Napoleon's condominium or empire, they agreed not to trade with the British. It was known as the Continental System. Now, on paper, it looked pretty good. The idea was to cripple the English economy, the nation of shopkeepers, as Napoleon derisively referred to them, to stir up domestic unrest to the point of revolution, and then like the apple falling off the tree, England would fall into the hands of Napoleonic France. Only problem is the Continental System hurt trade on the continent of Europe far worse than it did the British Isles. Again, when you understand this in light of some of these prophecies about who is going to inherit those magnificent blessings of Genesis 49, the answer is the descendants of Joseph in the last days. All right, this takes on perfect sense, or it makes perfect sense. Next image. Alexander broke out of the Continental System because Russia's economy simply would not function right without trade with England. And in 1812... you have Napoleon renewing preparations, as this period cartoon implies. Here he is with the image of death and the chess pieces and so on, renewing preparations for what would be a new campaign, moving not against England, but much like the Egyptian campaign, an indirect blow struck against someone else in hopes of eventually getting to the English. Now let's move on to the next image. Napoleon put together an army of 600,000. He moved into Russia, and as this period cartoon implies, with one stilt in Paris and the other in Moscow, the laws of physics just don't allow that to happen. You begin to have the unraveling in 1812, then, of Napoleon's great imperial edifice. In the next illustration, what we see here is what I would judge to be the critical battle in the Russian campaign. Now, Napoleon didn't consider it to be that at first. It, in a sense, became that as time went on. Here you have the Russian general Kutuzov, his hand extended, looking down on what undoubtedly was one of the most bloody conflicts of the entire Napoleonic Wars. It's Napoleon's first great land defeat, in my judgment, of three that I'll cite. It fell on September the 7th, the Feast of Trumpets.
Again, if you know what the Feast of Trumpets connotes, or at least in my personal tradition, it is a day when trumpets are blown, and trumpets are symbolic, among other things, of the call of the people to war. And it was a tremendous battle. Now, in practical raw terms, it was pretty much a bloody draw. But what it did is it mired Napoleon in Russia for the long haul, and eventually cost him an enormous price. Now, let me interject a biblical perspective here. Once again, this is my personal view, and you're welcome to accept or reject as you like. But it is not surprising in history for God to use, well, biblical history or modern history, I would suggest, for God to use non-Israelitish people to further Israelitish ends. And I suspect this is what we're seeing here. An example that comes at least immediately to my mind is 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter. Judah, under the rule of Jehoshaphat, was embattled by a Moabite-Ammonite alliance. They were outnumbered, outmanned, outsorted, I guess, up against the wall, and then from out of nowhere enter the Edomites. There's an engagement in which Judah doesn't even have to participate, and they go out and collect the spoil. Are we looking at a similar dynamic? Well, again, I'll let you be the judge, and I just simply say that these things seem to me to be very suggestive. Next illustration. This little book by Desmond Seward is an interesting one, and at least for those out of my tradition, when you consider what the book of Revelation says about the beast and so on, and resurrections of the beast and those types of things, it's hard to get around the fact, whether or not you understand or believe those particular things out of Revelation. These two men walked the same pathways in many respects. Seward takes you through the length and breadth. I'll simply draw a couple of items to your attention. If we'll go to the next little bit of imagery. Napoleon, in his Russian campaign, struck a blow toward an Eastern power which he was dissatisfied with. In the book of Revelation, you have a very similar thing predicted. It's called the first woe. Let's go to the next image. In response, that power out of the east strikes back. It's described as the second woe. Evidently, we have the grand fulfillment of that yet to look forward to. But as I said, I've asked you to think in terms of general patterns. Napoleon fit this pattern. Adolf Hitler fit this pattern. Are these forerunners? Are these developments which perhaps even in our own lifetimes we'll see begin to evolve and develop yet again? We'll have to wait and see. Next image. The typical Russian tactic is to fall back, slash and burn, leaving nothing to be used by the invading army. And the Russians, Napoleon arrived in Moscow full well expecting a delegation from Alexander to be there and offer surrender and get back into line. That was not what happened. The Russians, actually, again, looking at the Holy Day calendar framework, the day prior to Atonement of 1812 set the city on fire. And from September 15th through the 20th, which happened to be the day before the Feast of Tabernacles began in 1812, the fire ravaged that city of Moscow. Next image is an interesting one. And when I saw this, Napoleon, almost in frustration, seeming to be about to throw himself into the fire, being restrained by his guards. What came to my mind was a passage or two in the New Testament, Revelation 20, about the fate of Satan. In Revelation 19, we also read about the beast being cast into a place somewhat like what we see here. Matthew 25, verse 41, where it talks about there's a fire that is prepared for the devil and his angels. Now, Napoleon, granted, was a human ruler, but I think like many rulers who, in my view, would represent heads of beast powers that we've seen emerge through European or Western history, I suspect he probably from time to time was guided, directed, nudged along the way. And there's certainly evidence in the historical record that testifies to surprising, almost supernatural or occult type things that happen in the lives of people like Napoleon Bonaparte or Adolf Hitler. The Bible, moreover, says in Revelation 13, verse 2, that Satan gave his power to the beast. Revelation 16, I saw unclean spirits, three of them, like frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Again, I submit the question, are we looking at forerunners? I don't have the absolute answer for that, but I think we better stay tuned. Let's move forward in the images. Now, in France, obviously, and even still today, Napoleon is looked at as somewhat of a heroic figure. He brought glory to the French nation. Here you see him with a halo around his head. He looks almost like a saint. Across the English Channel, as you'll see in this next image, the view was, well, a little bit different. The Devil's Darling. There's a delightful little book on the cartoon history of Napoleon, and this is one of about a dozen or more images like this that continually crop up. If you'll go to the next slide, you'll see one. I think I only put two in here for today's presentation. I put this one in because of the particular caption, Apollyon, the Devil's Generalissimo, addressing his legions. Revelation 16, I think it is, talks about Apollyon. Revelation 9 and verse 11. This cartoon actually was published on the second day of the Feast of Tabernacles, which is not a particularly significant factor, but I'll just throw it in. When you read Isaiah 14, or for that matter, Ezekiel 28, you're reading along in one about the king of Babylon and the other about the king of Tyre. And it's almost difficult to tell where that story ends, and then suddenly you pick up with a story of someone called Lucifer, or the great angelic or cherubic being in Ezekiel 20, who was a created entity who seems certainly to represent who we would know as Satan the devil. Remarkable information that. And again, I have to ask the question, where along the way through history has Satan nudged, directed, guided, has God allowed him to do that? And maybe more importantly to us, where might these kinds of things begin to happen again? Next image. Napoleon retreating in defeat from Russia. And this is probably my favorite painting of the entire era, the Napoleonic era. Because of the subtlety, the artist was a Russian. His name was Cossack. You can see the signature in the lower left-hand corner. But Napoleon and his army of 600,000, which by the time it returned to France, numbered only 100,000. Deaths, desertions, and the like greatly diminished the numbers. Napoleon leaves, but notice the subtle and the almost taunting touch that is added in the upper left-hand corner by Cossack. What do you see? You say the Sphinx, and you are correct. In essence, what this seems to be saying is it didn't work, that is, trying to strike an indirect blow against Ephraim when you tried it in Egypt. And guess what, Boney? It's not worked now either. Fascinating stuff. You add to that another interesting dimension, which is, and I think I mentioned this in the morning message yesterday, when you think of Joseph's offspring, Ephraim and Manasseh, those two young men were a little different from the other descendants of the Israelite tribes. You see, their mother was an Egyptian princess. So the thread of Egypt weaves its way through the story of Joseph in interesting and, I think, very significant ways. Now, let's move on to the next illustration. Had the Allies against Napoleon realized how badly he was defeated in Russia, probably they could have ended the story in 1812, but it didn't happen that way, or 1813, as he moved his way through the winter of that year. In fact, Napoleon met with another major defeat, in this case at a place called Leipzig at the Battle of the Nations. Leipzig was a three-day confrontation which began in October, the 16th of that month, the year 1813, and it was the last great day of the Hebrew calendar. Military strategists who have analyzed the battle have suggested that if he had fallen back after that first day, he might have been able to save the circumstance or save the situation to live to fight and succeed another day. He didn't choose to do that. And in fact, as we see here, the Corsican hound, is it? bloodhound caught by von Blücher, the Prussian general. That would be the first of two times von Blücher would be a problem for Napoleon. Napoleon, let's go ahead to the next slide, fell back to Paris. The Allied armies moved in behind him. And as you can see here, he was at point of sword and gun, if you will, forced to abdicate. The date here is an interesting one. Some of the literature that has been produced out of my tradition actually has mistakenly put dates down wrongly. In fact, what we do know is that Napoleon tried to surrender in the midst of the days of unleavened bread. He was not willing to make sufficient concessions to the Allies. So he came back, and on the seventh or last day of unleavened bread, that day which in my tradition pictures the utter and complete defeat of sin, or if you think back to the example of the Egyptians pursuing the Israelites into the Red Sea, the defeat of Egypt and the hosts of Pharaoh, it is on that last day of unleavened bread in the year 1813, I believe it was. Let me see if I can pull that date quickly for you. April 11th, 1814, an impregnable ruler winds up falling. Now let's go to the last couple of images and we'll wrap this up for the morning session. Napoleon submitted his letter of abdication, but as we'll see in the next image, he was none too happy to do so. Not a happy camper, as we used to say at SEP. Now, I want you to keep that image in mind, and when we come back, I guess in probably about an hour and 15 minutes or so from now, we'll pick up the story of Napoleon, and then we'll go from there and survey the landscape in April 15 and see where the fortunes of the relative players lay. And I'd like to conclude with some suggestions about the Commonwealth, the British Empire, and what it was that what it is that we see as we gaze back in retrospect on what came to be the greatest empire that the world has ever known. Thank you once again for your attention, and let's see, Craig or I guess Mr. Dean, probably you may have some final comments about when we come back. As he's coming to the stage, let me also say, because of some technical problems that we had, if you will excuse me for about the next 20 minutes, I'm going to have to transfer slides from one tray to another, so I'll need a little while to organize the final presentation for this afternoon, but then I'll be, I think the deans are going to we're going to lunch together, I believe, or some such thing, okay. And then I'll be happy to stay around in the afternoon after the second presentation and talk until we have to leave, I think, at around 6:30. Okay, Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Rick. Just a final comment. If anybody is not fully understanding the holy day that Rick has referred to, there is a booklet back there. Maybe someone can just hold it up for me. The orange one, the holiday booklet. Mike, jump up, please. I didn't get up there. Just show you the one that is. That one there does explain the holy days from the Old Testament and their continuing understanding as they flow into the New Testament and the references that Rick has made throughout this presentation. So if anybody is not aware of that connection, that booklet will give you that bit of understanding to fill in that gap that the comments that Rick has made. Okay, I assume we'll be back at, I'm looking up at the back there, Craig, 2 o'clock, is that correct? 2 o'clock, it's only 1:45 now, isn't it? Oh, is that right?